So welcome to the July episode of our Stinging Fly podcast. My name is Declan Mead and I'm here today with Martina Evans, a poet and writer and teacher, who's written 11 books of prose and poetry, and her most recent collection of poems, Now We Can Talk Openly About Men, has just recently been published by Carcanet Press. Martina is going to read a story for us, and she has selected to read The Day I Brought Water by Sinead Morrissey. So, hello Martina.
Hi Declan.
You're very welcome to Dublin from
you.
London. And can I ask you to read Sinead's story for us, please?
Yes, I'd love to. The Day I Brought Water by Sinead Morrissey. It's nearly nighttime and it's summer, so the sky is red and animal clouds are in it and moving quickly. Summer means fires on the estate, houses and mattresses and cardboard boxes. I'll find them on my way home through the back path. The whole sky full of smoke and boys running. And when I go inside for my tea, I'll talk about the new fire. Summer means mum sunbathing out where the bins are and eerie wigs all over our house, in keyholes and towels and beds, and the whole street skipping with one big rope singing, On the hillside stands a lady, until bedtime. Parents coming out in twos and fours, then to bring us in, and the last one tying up the big orange rope and going away somewhere else because he's lonely. Nearly bedtime now, but I want to watch the news all by myself, so I'm taking my TV that rolls docks and boats in the Tower of London across the front of it to row, row, row your boat gently down the stream, out to the playground in the middle of the back path. I'm setting it on a wall and winding it up and sitting down in one of the big round seats by the round stone table in the living room part of the playground. The big girls with tall black shoes are nearby and some of them come over to me. Can I brush your hair? They're sitting round me in a circle and when they're finished I get up onto her lap and I brush hers. I remember her. She was the babysitter once and we watched a film with pirates and ships and cannons and she laughed when Dad asked her if she wanted something to drink. Laughed about it with her friends who came later, just before we went to bed. I'm telling her again how she looks like the woman I saw singing on TV. Who? Susie Quattro? The girls are laughing. They're leaving together now, back down to the big road at the front. The sky is dark red now and the clouds are black. Boys are here in the part that's lower down than everywhere else. They're jumping on top of a blanket they've set on fire. They come up to the wall and knock over my TV. I'm running behind the wall to pick it up. I'm running home. All sun. My brother leads us through bushes opposite our house and inside there's a space. Somebody's made chairs from planks and tires and boxes and everyone is here already. The whole street, but we've missed it. It's stopping. So we come back out again. The bushes have the white squish berries all over them that kill you if you eat them. The whole street goes off together and leaves me and my brother and Richard. And now the three of us are far away from the back path and we've been walking for a long time. All sun. We see a dog with one eye. Four men are lying on the grass under a bridge. We go over to where they are because they told us to. We're standing now, watching them. Mostly they do nothing, but sometimes they spit. They're looking at their shoes. They only have vests on top and their faces are dirty. Will you do something for us? He's talking to my brother. They don't have shoes. They have big black boots scraped away and white around the toes. What? He's not smiling. He's not promising things. Will you bring us something? Before they promised sweets and I went with them. I saw chocolate bars and chews and rocks. So I followed. What? He's not smiling. He's not giving us anything. Will you bring us water? The last time was nearly nighttime and the sky was red, red for ages and ages. Now it's after lunch, all sun. They lie and spit and stare up at us, into the sun. Water. Only one of them is talking. Every time he speaks, the other three laugh and roll about, pulling at the grass. Yeah, water. 4 big pint glasses of water from your house. Is your house close? Can you get there and back in 10 minutes? They're all suntanned. Their hair looks wet. They push their fingers through it and it stays where they leave it. No, it's further than that. About 20 minutes there and back. The one speaking has curly hair. It's light. The colour of skin in pictures. 20. Well, lads, is it worth waiting for? They laugh, far back in their mouths as though they don't want to laugh at all. Jesus, Mick, lay off it. He's looking up at my brother and his voice is a different voice now. We're thirsty. It's that simple and we want 4 big pint glasses of water from your house. That's 20 minutes from here, there and back. So you and your 2 wee friends are going to go back to your house, get the glasses, fill them up with water and bring them back to us. And you won't be any later than 20 minutes and you won't spill any along the way, okay? He's looking like someone else now. The tall one. The one with the I know voice. Do we get something? Sweets. Clove rock. And lemon bonbons. And curly whirlies. On the top shelf of a wardrobe inside a bricked up house. No, you don't. You get to do us a favour, okay? Christ, kids today, running fucking businesses. He spits. The others roll away. They lie with their feet towards us and they look up at the bridge. He's staring at my brother and we've whirled around and we're running into the sun. They didn't move, but we're moving now. We're running. My brother shouts out that we're running to beat the clock. I don't know the bridge where the men are lying, but now we're in a street. I can remember it. I asked a big girl to tie my laces here and she did. But into 100 knots instead of just 1, and they wobbled in a pile on top of each foot. I had to put my feet up, 1 by 1, onto Dad's lap when I got in, and I watched them all come undone under his fingers. And we're into another street now, and from here I know the way. We come to the big road my brother sang Finders Keepers on, the road I always think of when I hear a "Why did the chicken" joke. The road me and my mum and my brother stuck out our thumbs on to try and make cars stop when we missed the bus from town, though no car did, and we walked all the way along the road until we got home. The men didn't move, but we're moving now. So quickly I'm tired, and I want to stop running, but my brother is shouting how we've got to keep running to beat the clock. Past the school and the shop where I got the pink pretend jewellery set for my birthday. I watched it behind the glass every day until my birthday came, and then I bought it. And when Dad lifted up the earrings, they dropped and smashed on the bathroom floor. So he bought me a whole new pretend jewellery set in blue. Down the back path and past the playground with the low part in the middle and the living room where the 2 boys saw me sitting on the wall watching the big girls smoke cigarettes in their tall black shoes. The men under the bridge didn't move, but the 2 boys did and I followed them. I walked behind them and they turned around to me very often and smiled. They promised and I went, but when we got there, there was nothing there. And the one who was tall and thin told me the whole time when we were going where it all was, the things they promised, and he turned around as he walked and smiled at me the whole time. And it was nearly night time and the sky was red. Past the playground and down the back path to the big wooden gates showing the way to the houses. And I'm tired of running, but my brother and Richard are home already, so I keep running, right up to the back doorstep, and then I stop. I'm sitting and putting my head on my arm and my knees. I'm breathing quickly. My heart is loud. Glasses of water appear beside me in the biggest glasses we've got. They come 1 by 1 and stand beside my thighs. I watch them from under my elbow. They're dancing in the sun. The sunlight goes right inside the water and dances there, and I watch it through the glass. I think about the big shadow my brother and Richard run into in the hall every time they come out of the kitchen, holding another glass of water in both hands. When the shadow goes out into the backyard and moves across it in a line, until all the squares are covered, the sky's already gone red. I sat on the back step one time and watched it move across. It was straight like a ruler and slow, and the sky was red and the clouds not turning black, just redder and redder. I sat there for a long time. Mum and Dad standing in the yard had no shadows. They talked in low voices I couldn't understand. And then they just stood and didn't speak, just looking at the two boys who came in and stood in our yard. The two boys stood by the gate and didn't speak. It was quiet and the sun was red, and I could hear my heart still banging inside me. I felt the metal edge of the step hurt the skin under my leg, and I watched the big shadow move across the yard slowly, like the tide coming in straight lines instead of in waves. I'll take two glasses, because I'm the biggest. My brother has stepped over the glasses into the yard. He's shaking my arm. I look up and the sun goes into my eyes. He's handing Richard one of the glasses. Richard is standing behind me in the big shadow. One glass is still standing beside my thigh. Come on, you've got to take one too. I'm standing up and turning to the shadow and bending down to pick up the last tall glass with the sun inside its water. It's heavy and full. Richard steps past me into the sun, and when I turn round, we're all standing together and all of the glasses are in our hands. We can't run this time, but we'll walk fast. If we run, it'll spill. Let's go. My brother and Richard are moving up and down in front of me, getting more and more ahead like they're on boats. Their heads are down looking at the glasses. Their heads go up quickly sometimes as they look at the path, but then they go back down again. They're faster than me. I'm looking at them and I should be taking care over my glass, but I watch their heads instead. And when they go round the corner at the end of the back path, they're gone, and I can't watch their heads anymore. The sky is blue. There's no one else right to the end of the back path, and I'm beginning to hear my heart. I pass the last of the tall wooden gates, and now I'm at the playground. I can't see their heads, but the sky is blue. The sky was red, and no one was there, and I was in the wardrobe. I pushed against it, and it opened, and I ran to the window. Instead of glass, there were boards and bars, but part of the wood was broken. I saw so much red, I thought, new fires on the estate, new fires everywhere. And I was crying, but nobody was there. I can't walk anymore because I can't see their heads. So I'm putting my glass down on the ground. I'm sitting on the ground and bringing my knees up to my forehead. I put my hands around my knees because no one is here. I watch the colours that come when I push my knees into my eyes. Someone is touching my arm now. He touched my arm, and when I turned round, there was a boy standing in the room and he was carrying my trousers. He helped me to put them on, held them out, and I stepped into them. One, two, that's a good girl. And he took my hand and we found the front door and we walked out together. He held my hand the whole time and we walked along a long street. And in every front yard, boys were playing. I saw the tall, thin one right away, and the other was bouncing a ball against a wall, and he said no, but I said yes, and then he kept holding my hand, and he brought me down 100 steps, and at the bottom there was the back path. My parents stood at the back door, and he talked to them. Then he went away, and he came back with the two boys, and then he went away again. Come on, I'll take your glass too. You're too small. I look up, and the back path and Richard's face of a purple colour that's changing to blue because I pushed my knees up against my eyes. He's bending down to pick up the glass and I'm standing up and watching the blue go away from the ground until it's normal. But you've got to keep up this time or we won't beat the clock, okay? We're walking. I can walk with Richard easily this time and I watch the glasses as he moves up and down as well as forward and hardly any is spilling. There are long dark shapes under the bridge, so the men are still there. The one with the curly hair is looking at his watch. We're standing right in front of him now, but he doesn't look up. One of the others is sleeping. The other two are slapping cards on top of other cards that sit in a pile between them. They don't look up or stop playing, even though we've come back with the water. 34 minutes, children. I know, I'm sorry, my sister fell behind and sat down, so Richard had to go back for her. He's looking at me now. I want to sit down again, put my knees against my eyes and watch the colours. I don't. Your sister? I'm sorry, she's only 4. Are you only 4? I'm looking at my brother. His hands are full. I look back at the man and he's still staring at me. I don't speak. His voice is different again. Some cat took that child's tongue out. He spits. He drops the spit slowly to the side of his foot. Then he lifts up one boot and stamps on the spit with his heel. He looks back at my brother. Did you spill any? No. Lads, room service has arrived. Get your fucking act together. Sit up, you. There's a lady in front of you. He kicks the man who's asleep on his side, but he sits up so quickly I know he wasn't really asleep. The other two put down their cards slowly and turn their heads to us. Are we going to get those glasses, or are you just going to stand there holding them all day? My brother and Richard hand over the four glasses to the four men. They take them. Now they're all standing up, looking down at the water and the glasses in their hands. Thanks very much. And then he looks up, looks at my brother the whole time, and he empties the water with the sun in it into the grass at the side of him where he spat, looking at my brother. They all do it, one after the other, looking at my brother. Four taps turned on and spilling into the grass until the last glass is emptied and the sun's gone with the water into the ground. They're handing back the glasses. We stare. Richard and my brother take them, still staring. And the four men pick up their cards and walk away.
Thank you very much, Martina. So we've just been listening to The Day We Brought Water by Sinead Morrissey, which was first published in The Stinging Fly in summer 2003 and has just recently then also been collected in Stinging Fly Stories, which we published earlier this year. Martina, why did you pick that story?
I mean, I think I picked it for several reasons. When I was reading through the anthology, it was a standout poem for me. I'm also a fan of Sinead Morrissey's poetry. But it wasn't really to do with her as a poet. It was to do with the story itself. I just think it's a fantastic text. She's an amazing writer because she's got an absolutely amazing ear. She's got the ear of a poet. So it sounds wonderful. There's lots of lovely repetitions and so on. The child's voice is just pitch perfect. I love things that seem really simple.
Yeah.
And you could just dig down into this forever. And in fact, it makes me think of Persephone, the story of Persephone.
Right, yeah.
It could be a Red Riding Hood story or the story of Persephone. But what really was the deal breaker about reading it is because it's two stories.
Right.
I love doubling in literature. And another poet who is fantastic at doubling is Emily Bronte and Wuthering Heights. You know, you can never get to the end of it. So there's two stories. It's like it's going backwards and forwards, and it's very cinematic.
Yeah.
So it makes me think of, you know, filmmakers talk about rhyming. So there's this kind of rhyming going on of motifs, like the pink necklace and there's a blue necklace, and how one story reflects the other. And it's like we're going subterranean, you keep digging. And one of the things I absolutely love about it is the numbers. Two. So it's doubling, it's two stories. You've got four men, you've got two sets of two boys, you've got two necklaces, four glasses, my feet, my 2 feet, 1, 2. And then this 100 steps, 100 knots. The numbers come back all the time. And that's very kind of musical because I think music and maths are close. I'm very bad at music. At maths, I mean. I'm probably not much better at music, but I really admire when somebody else does it. And also, so the kind of main story, The Day I Brought Water, is like a quest story. And that reminded me of Homer, those foot races, or in Virgil, where they have to run and they have some, you know, they have the quest to bring the water, and the use of power. It's so cruel, isn't it?
Yeah.
And then the story that's underneath is amazing. And that's like a shadow. So I was going to talk about the way she describes shadows here. I mean, she's just amazing, the way she sees things. And then I went back to her poems because I remembered all the shadows in her poetry.
Sure.
Now I'll stop. Because otherwise you wouldn't get a word in.
Well, I don't necessarily need to get a word in at all. But I find the language really vivid. And there is that thing of the poet's eye, and you mentioned the ear of the poet as well, just being just as important. But yeah, when we published this story to begin with, I had just interviewed her about her poetry, which would have been probably at the stage where she'd written two or three collections, and her reputation has just gone from strength to strength, and the work has, of course, too, since that time. I mean, interviewed her in 2002, so she is much better known as a poet, of course, and continues to produce great work there. So, but we don't have many stories from her, you know. So that, I think that was part of the reason we put it into the anthology, apart from the fact that, of course, it's a great story in itself.
I think that poetry and short stories are very connected. Mm. And one of the things I love about this story, it reminds me of a quote by Stanley Kunitz, who's a great favourite of mine. And he said, a poem should never give up all its secrets. And I think the same is true for short stories, because I'm crazy about short stories. I absolutely love them. And that's what I love about them, is that the really good ones never give up all their secrets. And I think there's a secret hidden at the centre of this. And you can wonder about what happened. And I think that's been so wonderfully done, because it's a bit like what happens in real life. Often the scary things, the traumatic things, we're not really sure what happened.
Yes, yeah.
So we're trying to figure out, because when I read it first, I dived in and I got really into the foot race,
yeah,
the kind of Homer foot race about the water and the kids, because I didn't like the look of those fellas under the bridge.
Yeah.
And I was slightly confused
by the passing or the mixing of
the mixing of the two stories. Yeah. But I kept seeing other things in it. Alice in Wonderland, because she goes down into the earth, and the magic of the colours. It's very cinematic, and I think poetry, and I love film as well, and poetry and film are very connected. But also, that dog felt to me was like Cerberus, because I've really felt that once the back path is like Red Riding Hood on the path.
Yes.
And then the predators are everywhere. And they're not suddenly you realise they're not just grown, scary men lying under bridges, but they're older children, which is so true.
Yeah.
It's about the vulnerability of children, and that comes into her poems about her own children. There's a wonderful one where she talks about Baltimore, watching The Wire, and all the noises and tension of Baltimore getting into her head when she hears a child's cry in Belfast. Although to me, my idea of Belfast is a bit like Baltimore. I mean, the old Belfast, I suppose. The other thing it reminded me of completely was, so they passed the one-eyed dog, and I thought that's some version of Cerberus. They've gone to the underworld. And I know you often, in those Norwegian tales, you often have the trolls and things that are under bridges. Mm. But when I saw the number 4, because I'm big into Westerns. So yeah, I might say, I know that when I fall in love with something, I start reading loads of stuff
into it.
Unintended. But I have to say this, in a Westerns, you often have 4 men, often on horseback, the 4...
Right.
The Book of Revelation. But also, they're lying down and they want water. And I thought of Lucifer lying by the burning lake in Paradise Lost. And it's pretty hot and they're pretty thirsty. And he's got pale curly hair, like an angel.
Sure.
And he had the Lucifer's attitude as well, which is he's in a sorry state, but he's still going to do evil.
Yeah. Well, given, you know, what we... when we read Sinead Morrissey's poetry and hear her read it, I mean, she does, one of the amazing things I think about her is that she generally brings about 2 or 3 things at least into the poem, and she'll have these references, and you don't need those references to enjoy or experience the poem, but obviously it adds to them. But I mean, she draws quite a number of things and tries to work on a few different levels at once, which is seems to be always her ambition for the poems as well, that they...
And you don't need to know. I mean, I think the thing is, when you're a reader, you just get so excited, you just start talking about different things. But I didn't see those things straight away.
Yeah.
I just saw a very simple story that was incredibly complex and haunting and full of feeling. And the other thing is, you know, I'm talking about Satan and all those things. Those stories are just hardwired into our system anyway.
Yeah.
We kind of won't know them all deep down because they're how we work.
Yeah.
And I think, because there's a... it reminds me of fairy tales as well, and about the transfer of power.
Sure.
I mean, the story is all about power
yeah.
and abuse of power.
Yeah.
which is if she was abused by those boys, which I almost thought she hadn't been, but then there's the putting on of the trousers.
Yes.
And I think it's very subtle leaving it like that, because that's often how things like that happen. People are left with a question, and there's something so touching about the other boy who comes and says, and again you have the counting, one, two, putting the legs, little. You can imagine her little legs. Things like all son echoes all gone.
Yeah.
And young children say all gone. And there's great loss here.
Yeah.
And she recognizes him, who he is, what kind of a person he is, because she's experienced it before. So she knows more than the brothers.
Yes, yeah.
She knows he's bad.
Yeah. I mean, there's obviously, one of the things is that it's, you know, it's a hot summer. Let's say it's Belfast. And there's great freedom for the children, you know. There's that joy as there as well, being celebrated.
The mattresses and the...
Yeah. But at the same time, then there is this threat and danger. And so there's the current danger and then the previous danger that the child has experienced on her own. And that's all kind of interwoven into the story.
And the humour, actually.
Of course, yeah.
At the girls laughing when the father asks them to do whatever they want to drink. And you can really see those... you know, those girls. I also think she's got an architect's eye as well.
Mm.
Like, I could see where everything was. And to do that, this is not a very long story.
No.
There's an awful lot in there. And it was interesting because I then reread a poem from Parallax that I think...
Right.
Kind of. Well, I could read so many poems that connects with this, but I'm...
Yeah, so you were going to read this particular poem.
Yeah. So there was... when Sinead reads it, I hope I've got my explanation right. But anyway, this is how stories get twisted. I hope I didn't. Basically, Kapuscinski, famous Russian poet and writer who went to Siberia. And when he was there, he met a little girl. He thought it was very cold. And she said, when it's really cold, when we breathe out, the fog comes out around our body and forms a shape, and then when we move off, the shape stays behind. And she said, Sinead said something basically like, so when you go to school, you can see who's gone before you, because their shape is still there.
The morning, yeah.
And I just think it's such a gorgeous poem. Anyway, so I'm going to read it. It's called Shadows in Siberia, according to Kapuscinski. Are upright. Cast not by sunlight, but by frozen breath. We breathe and are enveloped in an outline. And when we pass, this outline stays suspended, not tethered to our ankles, as our sun shadows are. A boy was here, fantastically dressed against the Arctic frost, like an heirloom glass in bubble wrap. He has disappeared into the portico of himself. Not even Alice, with her knack for finding weaknesses in the shellac of this world, left so deft a calling card. I just think that connects with the story, because I thought of Alice straight away.
Yes.
And this, she has this thing with kind of subterranean passages in her poems. There's a wonderful thing when her son gets this bacterial infection and she describes it going through his intestines. It's in a poem. And like all the little brick terraces, I think, of Belfast.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, it's the other thing. Her work, like, it just breathes. It, you know, it's a bit of a cliche saying Belfast. You know, people like to say a place is a character. They might say, oh, Baltimore, for instance, is a character. And I think it's more like it's infused. And I think Belfast is so infused into this story as well, which I had to... merger with my Cork accent.
But I've heard you say during the week that because you've been over teaching on our poetry workshop at our summer school, but you were saying that, you know, for you anyway, place, you recognise it now as being, you know, essential really to writing.
Yeah.
And to good writing. And do you want to talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, a lot of things I've discovered through teaching, because I had about 5 books published before I taught. And then I didn't know how I was going to tell people how to do that. So that was my MA, learning to be a teacher. And I discovered things I'd start with, you know, the usual ding-dong point of view, place. And I realised once you started place, it it was never long before characters started crawling out of the woodwork, and how powerful it was, and also powerful writing, getting people to write about places they'd left, and how connected we are to place. And I'm interested actually in how that's going to change now, because places are changing and we're just being whizzed around at this very speedily. And in fact, we're losing our connection with place, because we're more likely looking at our phones now to get from A to B.
Yeah. As like we did earlier, yeah.
Yeah, so I think the geography here is, the place is fantastic. And for me, I love Sinead's poetry, and I'm very passionate about the fact that the narrative poems, stories were always told in poetry up to the 19th century. Sure. And they got split in two, and people have got to the stage where they think that if there's narrative in it, it isn't a poem. And I think Sinead gets that, you know, because drama is always at the centre of a poem.
Yeah.
So you have place, and the other thing, you have time. And I think the two of them really go together, because time is abstract and place is concrete. It's where you can, you know, get your grips into it. You can describe it as a thing. Time is very elusive, but if you're good at handling it,
yeah,
then you're a very good storyteller. But the physicists tell us that they're one and the same thing. So I'm trying to kind of understanding that now, but it's true in a way, because our past is tied up in place. It's very, very connected, and that's where you get your stories, the memories, the muse. Not always directly, you know, because, I mean, memories, imagination anyway. I think I'd like to say about colours as well.
Yeah, of course.
The use of colour here is astounding.
Yeah. I mean, there's the reds and the blacks and the blues and purples. And
yeah. I didn't think there was purple. There's an awful lot of red. There's an orange.
Yeah.
And I thought it was very interesting.
I think when she's on the ground and the brother comes up and she's had her
it's
eyes
like violet.
Squished up. Yes.
Yeah. I forgot that. And also, I love this idea. First, there's a pink necklace, and then there's a blue necklace. They're almost like representing the two stories and the loss.
Mm.
And blue is kind of a sad story, or a sad... Because I think the other thing about pairing in it and all this doubling up, parents come out in twos and fours to bring us in. But there's one parent left at the end, tying up the orange, big orange rope, and going away somewhere else because he's lonely. And that's like a coda, I think, because I think she's been traumatized in some way, and that makes you separate from everyone else. Because I think stories are also about connections and disconnections. And this is about somebody who got disconnected.
Yeah. And you can see that in the story itself. I mean, she has stopped short of telling us any more than she, whether she remembers it or not, we don't know, because it just stops at the point and picks up again afterwards, you know, putting the trousers back on. But, you know, so this is left out.
I think children do forget.
Yeah.
And I think they often, they develop other stories to tell.
Mm-hmm.
So when it gets, more scary the story gets, the redder it gets.
Yeah.
The sky was red for ages and ages, you know. And she says again here, I find it. Oh, the walking in and out of the shadows is amazing as well. So the red and the black is very satanic as well, I think, colours. Blue is a... Red is very up close and hot and scary, and blue is far away. I mean, there's also smoke in it. And there's actually another poem about shadows and smoke. And I'm just going to read... Actually, I'll read the last line of it. It's a poem that's simply called Shadows. I mean, honestly, I could sit down now with the horror books, but I don't want to scare you or the men who are recording here. The very last, it's this gorgeous thing about standing on a platform. And again, the way she observes, it's incredible. She's incredibly observant. But at the very end, it's about watching shadows on a platform, and she kind of riffs on that. But it comes back to shadows of candles on a church wall at evensong. They manifest not as flame, but as smoke. And there's so many shadows in this that I think the shadows represent the unconscious and the traumatic story.
Mm-hmm.
Because they turn and walk into the shadow and they have to go back. And in this poem, she talks about the difference between those shapes that the one in Siberia. She said, you have a shadow, it's like a shadow, the frozen breath, but it's not tethered to our ankles like our sun shadows are.
Yeah.
So in a way, that reminds me, it's almost like the trauma or childhood trauma. You have that forever tethered to your ankle, in a way. Because I think anyone reads this story and likes it should just go back to her poetry or discover her poetry and find all those shadow motifs. Yeah. I mean, this. I'm sure there was more to say. I'm just trying to think if... I bet I'll be still talking when I go down the road, driving you mad.
I'm going to ask, though, to you a little bit more about place and in terms of your new book, Now We Can Talk Openly About Men, and very much tied into place. But I wanted to... Because you've lived in London now for 20 years or so, and this book brought you back to Cork and then also to Dublin and back into our history. But and then also, I guess that relates to connect and disconnect for you in terms of Ireland and Cork and Dublin and now being in London.
Yeah, I mean, at the risk of repeating myself, because I've written an essay on it for the Irish Times and I've been interviewed, but it is interesting about connecting and disconnecting because I was reading Proust. As you do in your late 20s. I had a cat called Marcel. And in fact, if you read the book, there's a cat called Marcel in it. But he's called after the first Marcel. I was reading Proust and I wanted... In fact, my ambition was to read him in French and all of Flaubert. And I study French and I had all sorts of plans. I was a radiographer, but I was doing an Open University degree and I really wanted to do arts. But when I arrived in London... the Birmingham Six and the Guildford Four and just general, a lot of people weren't too happy with us going round with the bombing campaign and everything else. So when people said things, I think most people tended to keep their head down, but I thought they just needed to be explained. Yes. They needed this explained to them properly. And of course, that only made them more angry. And people really didn't... I think people have become a lot more cynical now about justice and understand that, you know, that the court process is not a kind of black and dry thing with a clean result at the end. So the idea of questioning British justice was, you know, frowned upon. And also, I'd get kind of worried because their version of the history was so different to mine.
Yeah.
So... Flaubert and Proust were just thrown to one side. I used to run down to the Green Inks bookshop at lunchtime. Well, I used to go down to the Green Inks bookshop or up to the Highgate bookshop where they were all very posh in English. And I'd spend my lunchtime there reading up about Irish history and I became fascinated. The other thing was trigger was my father died. He was born in 1902 and he died and I hadn't asked him all the questions. And of course, immediately, he'd been in the IRA as a teenager, been picked up by the TANs, he'd been in the Civil War, and he'd been talking about the Civil War when he was dying because he thought he was back there because he'd brain secondaries. And suddenly I was really interested in it. And I began to write stories about it because I'd seen a letter, poems. And then I went to a conference and someone was talking about IRA women and that connected to the coming on with my grandmother who was in the Land League. Right. And went to prison, Limerick Prison. And I got this idea, and I think I was very scared actually that it seemed a bit too big for me, but that I was going to write a novel about these Republican women. But I, talking about connections, I couldn't connect to them.
Yeah.
I was fascinated with them, but I couldn't. And I ended up, because I'm very interested in about children, I think children in danger. It was another probably big draw about this story for me. So I ended up writing about all this amazing stories, and I became obsessed with teenage boys of all kinds in Afghanistan and everywhere. And I began to understand how they were all hostages. Children are kind of hostages, but teenage boys, particularly in war.
Yeah.
And my father had been a hostage for the Black and Tans, and my uncle Tommy. And when I was putting that book together, facing the public, Israeli soldiers were using Black and Tans or using Palestinian boys as shields. And I thought I'd forgotten all about that story. But I had tried to write about it. But I had actually, in my mind, it was Wynn's Hotel. The second half of the book is mainly in a hotel.
Yeah,
and I was thinking of Wynn's because I was going there when we were up from Cork meeting people, because they'd all come up after the GAA matches, which, as you know, I was enthralled to. And actually, I was thinking about Mallow, which we had a kind of a Georgian past, but I lived in an old crumbling Georgian house, which I was trying to do up myself badly, plastering walls and filling holes with sand and concrete and stuff. And in many ways, I put that house a bit in. Yes. So I was kind of merging them in my mind. But I had thought I'd shaken them off and they came back. But it was about finding the probably not, well, a way to connect. But it was the fact is there is no way in God's, in on earth that I could be in the head of a common man in 100 years. Yeah. Didn't have the religion. It's very hard for us to look back and see this kind of golden future for women or men in Ireland.
Yeah.
But then I suddenly realised that I was now middle-aged. I was the age of the women in the books. And I thought it'd be really fun. I knew I could do them, being aghast and worried and anxious. Yeah. And then I connected with them.
Yeah.
And I think my mother was in there and Joyce is in there. Because I don't really believe in historical novels, so I was nervous about that. My father was born in 1902, so I could remember how he spoke. Strange. I mean, one minute he'd be saying, God blessed it, and the next minute he'd be saying, by Jove. Weird. You know, he was Edwardian child, and they grew up landed gentry on all sides in County Limerick with horses. So I used his language. I used my mother heavily, and if I was stuck, I'd stick in James Joyce. They were killed laughing. A bit of a chump, browned off.
Yeah.
There was a few things. So, and I connect very much with James Joyce. And he's very Cork.
Well, his father was originally from Cork,
and I think whenever Ulysses gets really interesting, John Joyce is speaking through him.
Okay.
Like in the Cyclops episode.
So it's really
it's a Cork book, basically.
Okay. Yeah, we've heard it here first.
Yeah.
Good.
And if you hear him talking, he doesn't have a Dublin accent.
Okay.
It's another conspiracy.
Just let's go back to The Day I Brought Water, the Sinead Morrissey story, and the point of view of the child. And talk a bit about point of view. I mean, you mentioned that coming across it along with place when you first started teaching. So,
yeah, it's very, I mean, it's very interesting. And especially here because it's wrapped up in voice. And of course, voice is connected to place.
Yeah.
So, you know, every kind of aspect of writing can come back to place. But I think the way she does the child's voice, you know, if you sit down to do it, it's not easy. And she's very good at it. And it made me think actually of the Emma Donoghue book, but this is long before it. And I was interested to know if she'd had a child by then, because I know that Emma Donoghue said it would have taken her 10 years to write The Room if she hadn't had children already. But I think we all, looking back to our forefather, the man from Cork himself, James Joyce, one of my favourite poems in the whole world is the first two pages of A Portrait of the Artist.
Right, yeah.
And of course, that's where he started to develop indirect style, which is where it's in the third person, but it's the voice of the person. And it's so beautiful. And maybe there's a bit of it here. You know, my father looked through the glass, he had a hairy face, and once upon a... Yeah, because she's got the nursery rhymes here and she's got the song. Once upon a time, there was a moo cow going down the road and where Betty Byrne lives. And
I mean, I think one of the problems with child point of view stories, and we'd often get a lot of them into the magazine, can be that they're told almost with a wink. As in, you know, that, well, here am I pretending to be a child, but we all know that I'm an adult and this child is doing precocious things. And, but, you know, and the adults are saying these things and isn't it all hilarious in a way? But obviously this is a much more serious story and we've talked about the threatening undertones of it, but and what may have happened to the child. But it's just done so well. As in, nothing here is superfluous to or extra to what the child might well be thinking and saying if the child were here now talking to us.
I know, it's really hard to do this. Yeah. And like a lot of things that are really hard to do, it looks really simple. And also the way, with just like a little kind of sleight of the hand, you really get a feeling for mum. Those little things she says about mum sunbathing by the bins.
Yeah.
And that feeling of poor old mum trying to get a lift, missing the bus. The love between them comes through. Mm-hmm. You feel her connection with her mum. And that makes it even more painful.
Yeah.
Because her mum unfortunately couldn't be there for her when she was in danger. So I do, and I think I suppose it's interesting to think where we are now and looking back to Joyce, because people now, we talk very much in the first person, we use free indirect style, we talk in the demotic, in the language they would have used. So here, but it's very difficult. The one thing that popped out at me was the word thigh.
Yeah.
That was the one word, and I read it to my daughter as well, and she said, oh, that did too. Because I remember her, she used to say the tops of my legs when she was a child. But a specific child could use thigh. The only reason I wondered about thigh, was it a hint about what happened in the wardrobe? And maybe she learned the word because of the questioning afterwards. But I feel this is something very, very murky, like those smoke left by those candles she's talking about, where the flame looks like smoke.
Yeah.
And I think this story is like flame and smoke, isn't it? But smoke and mirrors.
Yes.
Because there's an awful lot of mirroring in it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you very much to Martina Evans for talking to us today. The Sting and Fly podcast will be back next month. And thank you very much to the Arts Council for their ongoing support.